Welcome to Stout Audio, produced at Spruce Knob Studios in Middletown Springs, Vermont. Stout brings you stories and ideas about the things you've seen a thousand times but never really looked at. Welcome to the show. Here's your host, Herb Childress. Today's story is one from a series called A Field Guide to Men of the 1970s. Short stories about men who had to make themselves new as the deals were broken when their reliable landscapes dissolved around them. Today's story is actually a real story about my father, but it's fiction because I'm telling it from the point of view of his friend, Bill, the friend who got my dad a job even though he might have needed it more himself. No one ever talked about why he did that, and I always wondered. But that was 45 years ago. They're all dead, and I have to explain it for myself. So here's a story set in Muskegon, Michigan in 1973. It's called Loyalty. Tony had finer hands than any micrometer. He could hold an assembly for 30 seconds, a bearing or a bracket, a spring set or a rocker, turning its parts against one another, and tell you where the failure was most likely to occur. He could feel hidden looseness that would cause premature wear, the unpredicted lateral stress that would crack an engine mount 5 years later. He threaded freshly dyed screws into freshly tapped holes and told you where to look for a burr in the metal. Then he'd do it with a second one to tell you whether the tap or the die itself was scarred. Whenever he was considering a problem at work, he'd leave a cigarette burning in the ashtray, and he'd thread a machine screw between his fingers, in and out of the cone of left thumb, index, and middle fingers, while he looked at the other parts. It was like he was asking the machinist gods for assistance, turning his threaded rosary until they came through. He had never been formally trained, had left school in seventh grade to head with his family from Arkansas to California, picked up with a shipyard in Long Beach when he was just 14. He'd already been working on the family Buick for 10 years, never afraid to take anything apart, radios, telephones, toilet valves, differential gears. Now, in his late 40s, he'd seen almost every kind of metal assembly there ever was, from automotive to industrial to aviation. He felt forces, knew where the work required rigidity and where it wanted give. He knew materials, felt the right uses for soft brass and for carbon steel. He'd never been to engineering school, couldn't do math past fractions, but if you gave him a 5 1/4 inch drive shaft in a mock-up assembly, he'd come back with it supported in thirds, the two mid-shaft idler bearings exactly 1 3/4 inches apart. A wolf doesn't know how to hunt. A wolf is hunt, in blood and spirit. And Tony was a machine. It was 4 o'clock on a Thursday when the end came. We'd been hearing rumors for a month, closing down altogether, moving south like Harrison Ironworks, all kinds of shit. I just ignored it and came to work and did my job like I had every day for 23 years. Don't borrow trouble, my old man used to say. But it was 4 o'clock on Thursday, December 20, when the shop steward came through the machine shop with pink slips. "Bad news, boys," was all he said as he handed us each an index card. "Continental Motors Incorporated regrets to inform you that your position is terminated, effective 5 p.m. December 20, 1973. You can go to the Human Resources office in the C building on Friday, December 21, between 7 a.m. and 5 p.m., or on Monday, December 24, between 7 a.m. and 12 noon, to receive your closing paycheck, inclusive of unused vacation hours and accumulated overtime, plus a $200 Christmas bonus. Continental regrets that business conditions have made this decision unavoidable. We thank you for your dedication and hope that you and your families have a joyful Christmas and a rewarding 1974. "How many, Lou?" I asked. "I don't know. Lots. Not everybody." Some guys put their tools down then and there and walked out. Some guys took tools with them. Some guys smashed some of the equipment with the tools they took. Some guys took boxes of pens and paper clips, a petty balance against the layoff slip. Tony left empty-handed. Not a word. I didn't know what to do exactly, so I finished marking up the spec drawings for the fan assembly I'd been laying out. I hated to leave work unfinished. I was last to leave at 5:10. I turned the lights out behind me. The casualties held an impromptu union meeting at the Eagles Club. The Eagles had always been a Continental Club. The Elks from Campbell Foundry, the Moose from Bennett Pumps, Rotary for the Ties. The fraternal organizations drew their members like porch lights in times of trouble, the homing beacon of fellow men who knew things that others didn't. Larry, UAW Local 416 president, had opened a bar tab for everyone who came through the door. The first beer eased the pain a little. The third or fourth, accompanied by a couple of shots, amplified the resentments. By 6:00, there were 200 guys there. A busy weeknight would have been about 30 or so. Larry climbed up and sat on the bar facing out and clapped a couple of plastic ashtrays together. The churn of voices settled to a low mumble. Okay, let me tell you what I know. Total layoffs in design, drafting, machine shop, tool die and jig shop, all closed. About 40% layoffs in casting, 15% in assembly and warehouse. Looks like a total of about 820 jobs gone. A shout from the back. The fuck do we have a union for? Contract is wages and conditions, not structure. They decided their engine designs are going to come straight from their clients. Muskegon's going to be manufacture and assembly only. Another voice rose through the groans nearer to me. That's fucking crazy. We make better engines because we design them right in the first place. Listen, don't try to tell me I ain't the guy driving the Cadillac to the bank off of this. And I only learned it at noon today anyway. It ain't like anybody asked me how to go forward on this deal. He tried to carry on, to talk about the union's severance fund, but the churn had returned angrier than before, and he clambered down off the bar and got dragged into a side conversation with a crowd of a couple dozen. I left the commotion to go find Tony, sitting by himself off at the back. He had two empty Black Label bottles on the table, a third underway. His ashtray was full, one burning in the notch. Tony was built from beer, cigarettes, and machine parts, and one of the three had just been removed. The resulting assembly wouldn't be stable. You okay? I said. A stupid question. Tony looked up at me. Don't know yet. He held a slender screw, a manifold mount screw, fine pitch, 3 inches long, turning the hex head with his right hand and receiving the threads with his left. The machine gods were mute when confronted with questions of economics. How about you? I said, well, long term, probably okay. Short term, I gotta go home and tell Beth. That's gonna be rough. We were thinking about having her mom come live with us. She's gone senile, but with me not working, that's just another mouth to feed on no income. He wasn't listening to me, not really. It was just sounds, like soothing an injured animal. Five boys in Catholic school already eats us up, not sure we're ready to take in another. At least she won't cost us tuition or go through milk like a teenager. He was looking off into the middle distance, threading, unthreading, threading. The cigarette had gone cold, its ash longer than the filter, suspended across the notched rest of the ashtray. I'll see you here next week, Tony, right? He looked up at the sound of his name like an old dog, said, yeah, I'll be here. See you next week. I hadn't considered that next week, of course, was Christmas. I'd been to pick up my final check on Friday, went to the union office later that afternoon. The strike fund was going to be drawn down so that laid-off members would get 2/3 pay for 3 weeks. Good news. Beth had been a handful on Thursday night, but Friday's news helped quite a lot, along with some Canadian club, and I used a little of my Christmas bonus to bring home fish fry. On Sunday at Mass, Father Zajkowski said a prayer for the workers and asked those of us laid off to stay after Mass. He and Stan Torbica, the parish treasurer, let us know that as long as we were tithing, our kids could stay enrolled in both St. Tom's and in high school at Catholic Central. More good news. I had a few protected weeks to find work with a little extra bump to start with, the bonus and about 80 hours vacation. This layoff was starting to feel like a blessing, not a burden. At least, until Monday morning. I'd never imagined spending Christmas Eve in an unemployment line, and I never knew what 800 laid-off workers really meant until we were all in the same place at the same time. Muskegon had had a decade of layoffs back to the early 60s. You'd hear about 200 guys at this shop, 500 guys at that one, 1,600 at once when the Norge refrigerator plant moved to Alabama 12 years back. But until you see us all together, standing on the sidewalk in the light snow, you just don't know what those numbers mean. It was 8:15 when I arrived, 1:30 when I got inside, 2:30 when I got to Mrs. Colleen O'Rourke, her desk covered with Christmas garland and two stacks of forms. She shook my hand, not smiling. Continental, right? Well, Bill Zajic, actually. Nice to meet you. She didn't smile at that either, just looked through stapled pages for the name. She was in the S's. It starts with a Z, I said. She shook her head, never looking up. Lived here my whole life, and I still can't spell Polak name, she said. It's Yugoslav. Z-A-J. That should narrow it down on your list. I was always the last one called on in class. That, finally, made her smile a little. She looked up and said, At Sacred Heart, we had a whole homeroom full of O's. She checked my name off the list, took a paper from the small stack at her left elbow. So here's what we need. She moved her pencil point down the form as she talked it through upside down, facing me. Name, date of birth, social security number, one pay stub from each of the last six quarters, name of each dependent, date of birth and social security number for each of them, last year's tax form. You can fill this out at home or you can bring documents with you and fill it out here starting on Thursday. But when you come back, you have to bring your pay stubs and your tax form no matter what. I felt a foreboding that no matter what information I brought, it would always be short one document, that I'd be in purgatory for a while. I joked to cover the stress. You got the drill down pretty good. A lot of practice today, huh? Yeah, and I still have to get home and get turkey in the oven for dinner after midnight mass. It's a good thing Continental let us know this was coming a couple of weeks ago. We had time to bring a few girls over from Grand Rapids to manage the crowds. A couple of weeks ago? Yeah, it was about the 10th or 12th of December. They wanted to make sure we'd have enough forms and stuff on hand. Continental's always been good to work with. Good to work with? They gave you 2 weeks' notice and they gave us less than an hour? I surprised myself by starting to choke up. Look at all these guys. Where are we all supposed to go? I gave them 23 years, straight from the Navy in 1950. It's the only kind of work I know. And what do they give us? A one-way trip to the sidewalk on Christmas. She said, You'll be okay. There's always work for people who want to work. She slid the form across to me. With 20 years' experience, you'll be first in line for a lot of jobs. Have a Merry Christmas, Mr. Z, and we'll see you with your paperwork after, all right? January turned to June. My unemployment, which didn't kick in until the union fund ran out anyway, paid half of my weekly wage. Beth and Timmy had a garden in. The older boys and I were hunting or fishing every weekend. I ate squirrel and possum when I was a kid, didn't hurt me any. And we brought in six turkey during spring season. There weren't many jobs to apply for, and each application took an hour or two, so I spent my time around the house. Smoked fish, redid the kitchen cabinet hardware, did tune-ups on our cars and on the neighbors when they needed. We kept the furnace at 58, wore sweaters and jackets. Beth sewed up the holes in the window screens before summer. We barked at each other some, all eight of us. Allowances were cut back all around, which never makes junior high and high school kids happy. And we put a $10 a week limit on gas in each car, which doesn't make boys happy at any age. We skipped the spring dentist visits, hadn't been to Burger Chef or Mr. Scribbs since winter. Opal had mildly rebounded, was able to help Beth around the house a little bit, even though we were giving her two of her pills a day instead of four, Tic Tacs for the other two. I was buying a pack of cigarettes a week instead of one a day. And Beth had quit completely, which amazed me. Continental had closed altogether by then, the entire operation down to Tennessee, a factory that had employed almost 2,000 workers, now dark. Rumor was that the new shop down south had fewer than 1,200. No union. Wages two-thirds of ours. One night, after all the kids and Opal had gone to bed, Beth and I sat at the kitchen table, half past midnight, one glass of Canadian Club back and forth between us. New class in a couple of weeks at the community college, I said. Industrial sales. It's only $10, 4-week class. I'm thinking about signing up. It's hard to sell things if no one's making them. She took one of the cigarettes from my pack, lit it, took one long drag, then handed the rest to me. How can anybody invest so much money in a factory and then walk away from it? It's like if we were just to turn the key in the door and leave it behind. Worse than that, I guess, I said. Turn the key in the door and leave it behind with the kids still in it. Beth shuddered. Is there anything at all? Or do we leave too? Don't know where we'd go. And with everybody in town laid off, we couldn't sell the house anyway. I leaned back, hands behind my head. Remember when we bought this place? Just married, you pregnant with Gary? You said, 4 bedrooms. Good Catholic house to fill up. She smiled. If I'd known we'd have 5 boys, I'd have been a nun instead. Really? I wouldn't have thought celibacy would have suited you. She laughed at that. I don't suppose it would have. But I tell you what, you give me another one and I'll cut your balls off and put them in a jar in the fridge. She finished the last of the glass. Come on, Bill. Let's put out the lights. Electricity's expensive. I saw Tony about once every 5 or 6 weeks at the rare nights I gave myself at the Eagles. His grown daughter had helped him through the process of unemployment, but he wasn't looking very hard. He had gone from one massive, voracious organization to another 3 times in his life, the shipyard, the Army, Continental Motors, and didn't have any experience in looking for work when factories weren't begging for workers. He said, every factory in town's full up. It's like a sump. When there ain't no more capacity, it just spills out the overflow. Well, Fisher Body's got some slots over in Grand Rapids, I said. They're shifting over to these small cars like the Vega, the Chevette next year. They're doing a lot of body work. I might go over there and ask around. I don't know nothing about sheet metal, Tony said. You could learn. I could learn to do a lot of things. Learn to fly, learn to tend bar, learn to sell insurance. But I ain't fit for none of them. He pulled a Winston out of the pack, lit it. Gordy Howe could learn how to play baseball, too, but he's built for hockey. Be ashamed to waste him on the wrong game. True enough, but I don't think our game is going to come back. I bummed one of his cigarettes. We've lost 8 shops since you and I started at Continental. What's that, 4,000 jobs? 5? Seems like we only got a few choices. We can leave town, follow Continental or somebody else down south. We can learn a new trade, even if it isn't our favorite. We can sit here and do nothing and drink ourselves to death. He said, not sure any one of those is better than the others. He'd somehow lost the habit of turning threads between his fingers, spun his beer glass slowly round and round instead, fingers against the smooth rim. My pa was a farmer, cotton mostly. He come out of the same dirt as his plants. He could look at the sky and see a raindrop 10 miles away. Taught me how to build a ladybug house, growing one bug to eat the other bugs. He planted okra around the fields because the aphids liked okra better than cotton. When the rain stopped, he tried for 3 years to keep growing, but we finally left for California. He got a job at a newspaper, ran the press, but he never quit being a farmer. He's like a zoo animal that dies from loneliness even when you give him enough food and water. He looked up at me, his face gaunt, dying of his own loneliness. I'm built for one thing, Bill, like my pa was. He's built to be a farmer. I was built to work gears and levers. My kids are built to work at desks. Both through college, they'll do fine. Who knows what their kids will be built for? I got them both launched. Maybe that's enough. It's our job, right? June became October. The industrial sales course had been pretty good, and I liked to talk to people anyway. I helped a small shop do paperwork and went with them to talk to the loan manager about an expansion, and they paid me off the books for my help when their loan went through. I'd been close on a couple of jobs, one in a shop making card dashboard instruments and the other as a salesman for a coil and leaf spring manufacturer. I felt like the clouds might lift. I got a call from the manager of the car instrument shop. One of his friends was moving to Arizona because of his wife's arthritis, and his employer was doing well and would almost certainly need to replace him. They only had 20 men total. So I called West Michigan Machine, and they were happy to have me come down to interview. When I got there, Tom Baker, the owner, took me into the vacated workspace. The tools weren't as big or as sophisticated as those at Continental, but I recognized them all. drill mills, bearing set presses, metal lathes, carbide saws, jugs of cutting lubricant. Tom put a gasket on the table next to a raw aluminum billet and said, "Use that gasket as a template and lay out that aluminum block like you're going to fit a cylinder head on it." 20 minutes later and I was done with the layout and had cut one cylinder bore, one threaded mounting hole, one smooth pushrod hole, and one triangular coolant chase. "Nice," he said, aligning the gasket to the layout marks and sample cuts. Then he handed me a rocker arm assembly. "Let's say a guy wants to go racing. What would you think about if you were going to build this up for tougher conditions?" I looked at it for a few seconds. "Yeah. Depends on how much he likes working on his own engines. If he wants to run it for a couple seasons without messing with it, I'd keep these hydraulic tappets so they self-adjust. But if he's a decent mechanic and doesn't mind getting in there every couple of weeks, I'd go back to solid tappets, because then he could adjust them finer himself and he wouldn't have to worry about pressurizing." I was about to look closer at the pushrod, but he stopped me. "$9 an hour, time and half overtime. Can you start next week?" "Wow, yeah, I guess I could. But you wouldn't happen to need a salesman, would you? I've been thinking about the business side more lately." I could hear Beth in my head, "Take the damn job, you idiot." But I was hearing other voices. "You'd be good at it in a bigger production shop," Tom said. "Help customers get their ideas better designed before they went into making quantity. But, you know, we're all one-off, custom work. Every machinist here works directly with a customer to figure out what they need and then builds it themselves. And we got a good enough reputation that our customers find us instead of us chasing them." "You know, listen, I'm grateful and I'd love the job, but I know a guy who's even better at this than I am. He and I worked at Continental and he was laid off same day as me. Can I use your phone?" He led me to the office and I called Tony's number. I was trembling, simultaneously praying for him and swearing at him. "You get one chance to answer, you cross-threaded dumbass." The phone rang once, twice. "Hello?" He sounded sober. "Tony, this is Bill. I'm at West Michigan Machine on Getty, just south of Norton. Get your ass down here in the next 15 minutes. I just got you a job." "Not quite what you wanted. What you wanted? What about me? What about us? I don't want to be poor. I don't want to have our kids hungry. I don't want to have to eat squirrel meat. I don't give a shit what you wanted. You need to make us a living." Beth knew Tony a little socially. Didn't like him much. She knew nothing about his work, his machine spirit. There was no way I could explain it to someone who hadn't seen it, especially not to someone fractionally shy of physical violence against me. "Give me his phone number. I'm going to tell him you're taking the job. He can be the one hungry." "Beth, no. I'm sorry you're unhappy." "You're goddamned right I'm unhappy." She was crying now, frantic. "It's been almost a year. I'm scared every day that we'll have to leave, that we'll be on some fucking highway like my Uncle Jim in the Depression. People starved to death. Do you understand that? People lost their houses and lost their land and got halfway across the country and broke down and starved to death like fucking African refugees. Is that what you want for us? Which one of us should starve first? Is it me? Is it Mom?" She grabbed a tomato from the bowl on the counter, hurled it at me, clipped my shoulder before it exploded against the wallpaper. "Get out! Get out now!" Another tomato above my head. "Come on, honey." She snatched a barbecue fork out of the dish drainer, held it in front of her. "You get out now or I swear to God I'll put this in your chest." I saw Timmy looking from the dark of the living room, rigid with fear. I left as quietly as I could. I slept in the car down at Mona Lake Park, washed up as best I could the next morning in the park bathroom. Stopped at a diner for coffee and an egg, and then back to the house around 10. I was ready to talk, or to listen, or to pick up some clothes as things developed. Beth and Timmy were in the garden behind the house. He looked up when he heard the car, scared all over again that our fighting would reignite. Beth never looked my direction, just kept pulling bean runners off their frames. "Hey, Chief, what are you doing home from school on a Wednesday? You feeling okay?" "I kept him home today so we could talk." She kept working, didn't turn to face me. "I've been telling him about how when people get scared, sometimes it looks like angry, but it isn't, not really. And I've been telling him about Saint Jude, the protector of the lost causes. How sometimes saints use the living to intervene and do their work for him. I told him about your friend Tony, the lostest of the lost, and how St. Jude used you to rescue him yesterday. I told him how you've done that before, too, how you do it now with Grandma. I told him about how you can be proud of someone and still scared at the same time. She turned toward me, finally, her eyes red. I missed you last night. That's the big thing, she said. You're a confident man, but still kind, and that's rare. That's one of the things that drew me to you in the first place. I borrow it sometimes, the confidence and the kindness both. But you have to make me a promise. You have to promise me that when St. Jude asks you to help out again, you tell him to go fuck himself, because you got a family to look out for. Timmy laughed out loud at that, and I crossed myself, put my hand on my heart, and said, I promise. It turned out that Tom from West Michigan Machine had been telling all his friends about this crazy guy who was good to his friend, the guy who found Tom the best machinist he'd ever seen. I got a call 3 weeks later from a shop owner who wanted to expand into a new line of work and had heard the story out on the golf course. Now I have 2 salesmen working for me, customers all over the eastern half of the country, and I make about double what I had as a machinist. Tony made it another 4 years before the stress failures from the cigarettes and beer overcame the renewed reinforcement in the machine work. Died of a heart attack at 54. But he was happy while he was still alive. The work of daily invention suited him even better than the big factory jobs. I'd seen him once in a while at the Eagles, itself falling into disrepair as the Continental Corps members dissipated. We talked a little, but I think he was always embarrassed that I'd rescued him. Didn't know how to bear that gift. His friends from the Eagles, me included, came back together at his funeral as pallbearers. I went to the viewing the day before, talked to his kids, stood at the open casket, slid a machine screw under his left hand. That's our story for the week, Loyalty, part of the series A Field Guide to Men of the 1970s. Thanks for listening, and we'll look forward to you being back with us again next week at Stout Audio.